this is Chris Doyle and...
This is Adrian Palmier.
Of Goodman Games East. And we are just glad you're listening to The Tome Show.
This show is a member of Goblin, the gaming broadcast network. GBNcom.com.
Welcome to The Tome, episode 48. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interviews podcast, and I am your Tome host, Jeff Greiner. In this episode, we will be slaying a 4th edition Pit Fiend with 4th edition monsters. Welcome again to episode 46 of The Tome, 4th edition Monsters. Chris Engler is back, and we recorded 4 more episodes where we discuss 4th edition news. It's worth noting, again, that all of this news was current as of the time of recording, and is coming to you only from official sources. No rumors or speculation is discussed on the episode, unless Chris and I came up with it in the moment as we looked at official news. And now I leave you with 4th edition Monsters.
Okay, this is Jeff Greiner, your Tome host again, coming to you with more discussion about 4th edition with Chris. Chris, thanks for coming on again.
My pleasure. Good to do this again.
Yeah. We've previously discussed some information about classes and races and magic and rules for 4th edition. If you're interested in checking those out, hop on back and look at those older episodes, and then as we get some time, we're going to go back and hit some of the updates and some new information on that. Those topics too. But today we're going to go into some new topics. We're going to start off by discussing monster news, and then we'll get into other things. And just like in the last time around, I'll be breaking this up into several episodes so you don't have to download our big, huge conversation. So looking at monster news for 4th edition, we have lots of different things going on. And part of it is just long lists of things that are going to be in the Monster Manual, which is interesting to some people, and some people probably won't care as much. But let's look up, first of all, about how monsters are being created for 4th edition. In previous editions, the monsters were created in a way very similar to the way characters were created. And with the 4th edition, they said they're not going to do that anymore. They're not going to try to balance the monsters with the same rules that they create the player characters. That way they can try to match the spirit of the monster more and fiddle less with the science and the numbers of the whole thing.
Yeah, I'm not a game designer, so I'm not really sure what they mean by that. Because at the end of the day, I mean, it all has to move within the same rule set. So I'll be interested to see how that translates when it's actually on paper.
And I think part of what's going on with that is before they said, you know, if a creature has X number of hit dice, they also have this many skill points and this many feats and that kind of stuff. And it sounds like with 4th edition, they're going to worry a lot less about that and say, look, this is a carrion crawler. It should have these abilities, regardless of its hit dice, regardless of how many skill points a PC would have at this hit dice. This is what a carrion crawler should have.
I guess that's a good idea, because then, you know, you don't get, you know, it becomes less and less like a video game where you're going through and, you know, the monsters just get increasingly tougher along a predictable scale. You know, you could have one foe that, you know, is typically faced by low-level characters, but it has this one ability that you really have to watch out for. You won't have that out-of-game knowledge knowing, okay, you know, this monster was designed so that we could beat it.
Right. And on this other hand, as a lot of people also do create their own monsters, a lot of DMs will create unique and individual creatures for their game. I think it's going to make it a little bit, in some ways, a little bit harder and a little bit easier to do that. It's going to be easier because there's going to be less number crunching and less of that to worry about. But at the same time, I think it's going to be harder to do it and make it balanced and make it at the appropriate power level that you want it to be at.
Right. But I mean, That's something that, I mean, in my games, I've always if I have created something that seems too powerful, I mean, adjusting on the fly is the best way to deal with that.
Sure.
And I remember, like, I just remember a lot of the games I played, because the reality is, I mean, and I don't know why a lot of role-playing games do this, where they have this game master section where they tell you, you know, okay, if you're not going to run the game, don't read it, because everybody reads it. And,
right.
You know, I just remember one DM in particular who, you know, we had somebody in our group that had the monster manual memorized. So the DM, you know, he didn't have the time to create a whole new set of monsters, but he would play around with the abilities or give them something else that, you know, just that was unpredictable. And so that sounds like that they're trying to make it so that you can do that with your monsters as part of what's printed in the book.
One of the other things that they're talking about now, they're changing some of the other mathematical formula, I guess, of the game and revolving around encounters and monsters. The previous philosophy was that a well-balanced encounter would use up about 25% of a party's resources, which meant in a given day, a party of adventurers would have about four normal encounters before their spells or their potions or whatever had been used up. And they say that made a lot of mathematical sense, but it turns out that it wasn't as much fun in a game.
Yeah, I mean, I guess they'd know. I mean, they do all the play testing. That doesn't mirror my gaming experience, but I mean, I'm just one guy. So I mean, if that's the feedback they've got, then it's good that they've reacted to it.
Right, and I wonder if part of that isn't the same mentality that brought them to change the way spells work too. The idea that you have a finite number of encounters or fights or whatever that you can do per day, and then it's time to go back and rest. So I wonder if they're not just trying to... I wonder if changing magic is part of changing this, just to allow people to adventure longer without having to stop and camp for the day or whatever.
Right, like everything was always... Like even just that word resources, you know, it smacks of the whole miniature gaming roots that D&D has, and just maybe that was some baggage that it never got rid of.
Yeah, it could be. Some more specific news, I guess, getting into some of the creatures of that are well known in the world of D&D. Let's start off with our good friend Asmodeus, former lord of hell and the devils, has been apparently promoted. He's going to be a god now. And Orcus is taking over hell.
Does that mean Orcus got demoted?
So to speak, I suppose. Well, because Orcus was like number two or number three in line to take over for Asmodeus. And there was always some sort of implication that all the devils are always scheming to overthrow the master and take over. Turns out that nobody was apparently ever able to overthrow him. He lost... Asmodeus loses his position of Lord of Devils by becoming a god. So
how does that change his portfolio?
Well, previously he technically wouldn't have had a portfolio in terms of abilities and what have you, because he wasn't a god before. He was just a powerful demon lord or devil. So
I guess he had a better agent than Orcus.
Yeah, well, Orcus seems to have done okay in the whole deal too, because he's gone from being, a powerful archdevil to being a more powerful archdevil.
See, I'm too old. I still think of Orcus as a demon.
Yeah?
Yeah, because in first ed, it was Asmodeus was the head of the devils, and Orcus was the head of the demons.
Well, and Orcus gets to, assuming that there's not any major changes coming down for the cover art, I believe Orcus is featured on the cover of the Monster Manual.
Oh, that's cool. So they're going to go away from a red dragon.
Yeah, it's actually, the art looks pretty cool. I don't know if I'm real fond of the design, I guess, of the new covers, but the artwork looks really cool.
Well, that's one thing that you could, for third edition and afterwards, you never could really knock was the artwork in the books.
Yeah. I agree. The artwork has been very good.
If you really, when you look at an independent release, and hold it up to Wizards, you really appreciate the art in a Wizards book. I mean, it's easy to take for granted because it's so good in every book.
Oh, yeah, it is. And there are some, third-party publishers out there that have just tremendous artwork also, but for the most part, it's night and day difference. You can tell if it's official or not based off of the art.
I agree.
So we've got some more discussion here. Let's go ahead, and since we're talking Devils anyway, let's talk about what's happening with Devils here. A lot of the old assumptions about Devils is different. It's changed. The Blood War is gone. Devils and demons are no longer fighting this unending battle against each other. That they're sort of retconning all of that and saying the Blood War never happened. Devils are now fallen angels. Some demons or devils have been changed. Some have been taken out completely or folded together into one creature. And then devils in specific are becoming more human-like.
Wonder what the Jack Chick crowd will think of that.
Yeah. I think a lot of the idea behind it is that if devils are fallen angels, then that means they're connected to mortals and it makes sense for them to be more human-like.
Okay. Interesting philosophical viewpoint.
Right. And some of the idea of getting rid of some of the demons and devils has been like, why do we need two creatures that do essentially the same thing? Just one's chaotic and one's lawful. Let's fold those together, and instead of having an Erinys and a succubus, just have a succubus.
Right.
So a lot of it's just sort of cleaning up some things too. But along with all that, they've also changed some of the cosmology. They've moved the planes. Hell is now, it's a plane connected to the astral plane, whereas the abyss is actually within the elemental chaos, the plane called elemental chaos.
So where do the demons and devils, are they in hell or are they in the abyss? Are they in both?
I'm assuming they're keeping things the way they were before, where devils are in hell and demons are in the abyss, is the impression I get.
But the abyss is more a visceral, mindless place, I guess?
Right. The abyss is
it's
being ruled by Tharizdun, who is, a god character who is known from the Temple of Elemental Evil adventures. He was this ancient evil that sort of planted the seeds of evil in existence back when everything was just a primordial sort of elemental ooze.
That's interesting, because the elemental planes were usually sort of, well, they were all alignment neutral, weren't they? For the most part, it was just sort of representing the entropy of nature.
Right, which is something else that's changing also, yeah.
Oh, really? Okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I don't know if it made it into our notes here, but there was some recent discussion about how they felt like, over at Wizards, that elementals shouldn't be stoic, emotionless sort of creatures anymore. They should have qualities that reflect, you know, whatever their element is. So the fire elementals will be passionate and fiery, that kind of thing.
Interesting. I always kind of liked the... It's not to say that what Wizards is proposing is a bad idea, but I always kind of liked the sort of, well, like to use your word, the stoic nature, how they just sort of existed. I mean, they weren't peaceful. They were very, you know, I mean, they were violent. They were raging, you know, I mean, encountering a fire elemental or a water elemental, you know, was very destructive, but they were just very operated outside of the confines of human or demi-human affairs.
Yeah, and I wonder if, yeah, and I don't know. All in all, there seem to be a lot of big changes going on as far as the philosophy behind some of the better known creatures in the game, and so I'll be curious to see how people react to that and how well it plays out. I've personally been a big fan of, you know, the old demons and devils with in the Blood War and all that kind of stuff. And so these are some pretty significant changes. I didn't realize until after the fact that they'd actually put some of these changes already into some novels, and they were novels that I had read. And at the same time, and I didn't even pick up that there were big changes. So I guess it works as a storytelling device, but I wonder how much it's going to change people's game worlds and their campaigns and that kind of stuff.
I guess it would just depend on how much people do planar adventures. I mean, myself, I didn't do a lot of planar adventuring just because I tend to run low to excuse me, I tend to run low to mid-level campaigns, which, you know, planar creatures just don't factor in. So it'll, like I'm repeating myself a little bit, it'll depend on the kind of campaigns people like to run.
Right. Well, we also have some more information here about how dragons are going to be different. And it was just recently released in the Monster and Worlds preview that just came out, a week or so ago from when we're recording, that they're actually going to get rid of some of the dragons and change the way dragons work a little bit, because bronze and copper and some of the good dragons just didn't seem very interesting. They wanted the monster manual to be full of things that you would actually encounter and fight, and adventurers don't tend to fight good dragons. And some of them seemed a little too similar, they thought, so they weren't going to put it in the first book and wait until later to put them in.
Right. I'm just going on with your notes here, just how I like the fact that a dragon's color isn't going to dictate its alignment. It's more just there's going to be stereotypical behaviors that they have.
Yeah. And I don't know if it's going to be a full... Like, if it's going to be completely flexible alignment-wise, we'll have to wait and see, I guess, until we see that. But it's definitely going to be a little bit more... It's definitely going to be different, I guess. A little less, dragons will be a little less pigeonholed than what they previously were. You know, if you're a fire-based dragon, that doesn't necessarily mean you're weak against cold magic, you know?
Yeah, I read that, and I was just... I guess I just didn't remember them being particularly weak in general, but I mean, I guess that was the case.
Yeah. Well, and I actually liked some of the things, like they mentioned in a playtest report that dragon fire actually caused something to catch fire other than just causing damage. It caught fire and you had to deal with the fact that now you're on fire because you got breathed on, which makes a lot of sense.
Of course. Yeah.
Which isn't something that happened in previous rules. On one hand, it makes a lot of sense. On the other hand, I wonder how this jives with the philosophy of making gameplay faster. Because it seems now as a DM, I've got one more thing to keep track of and one more set of dice to roll.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, you'd have your ongoing effect. And I guess, you know, if they're saying that, you know, dragon fire now catches real things on fire, I mean, they're making dragons more more physiological and less mystical.
Yeah, there might be some of that too.
Because I could buy the idea that, you know, dragon fire wasn't real fire. I mean, that it was maybe just, you know, an anthropomorphic representation of the power that a dragon has. You know, it's not actually combusting gas and producing fire, but it's just having some kind of effect on you that it's putting through the visual trappings of fire coming out of its mouth.
Right, right. I'll be curious to see how easy it is to run a dragon now, because they say they're going to include full stats for the dragon, no work required. Everything that you need to run a dragon is right there and ready to go. So it seems that they're trying to make the usage of dragons more commonplace for your game, which I guess makes sense in a game called Dungeons & Dragons.
Yeah, and it's funny just over the... various editions of Dungeons and Dragons, just how much they've struggled with the identity of, not, well, maybe struggled is a bad word, but how much they've really played around with the identity of dragons. Because I remember in first edition Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, the rules for them were so completely different than any other monster. I mean, you had, you know, that was the only monster that I remember that was in the monster manual. I don't know if you remember, but it actually had a percentage chance that when you encountered it, it would be sleeping.
Huh.
And, you know, it just, I guess it kind of makes sense, because when you think of, you know, I mean, D&D is very Tolkien inspired. So, you know, the best example of dragons from Tolkien that comes up in people's minds is Smaug, who was, you know, often depicted, you know, asleep on his treasure hoard. But it was just, it's just been interesting to see how they've evolved, and, you know, they're just sort of, again, sort of playing around with the dragon.
Sure. And I think some of that kind of change makes sense. Like, I don't necessarily want a rule in my book that says that a dragon might be asleep. How about I just decide as the DM what's best for my story? Maybe the dragons do sleep a lot, so maybe he is asleep. or maybe not. You know, I feel like I should be more free, I guess, to make those decisions on my own.
Yeah, I guess what I was trying to say earlier is just they really feel like they have to talk a lot more about dragons than they do about anything else.
Right, right. And I'm just saying that I think some of the changes that they've made over the years, they've gotten closer and closer to making dragons, I think, better for the game. And with that in mind, I'm going to hold out hope that they're doing the same thing here with Fourth. I don't see anything with dragons that actually upsets me in any way. So I'm hoping that I see more and more dragons showing up in the game.
Are they keeping the whole separating them by age? Like how you have the ancient and adult and young and stuff like that?
They're still going to have age categories, but they're going to have fewer age categories. They're going to sort of redesign it and have to worry less about the numbers and all that kind of stuff. So I get the idea that there's going to be broad age categories, you know, maybe just 4 or 5 age categories that dragons might go through.
Yeah, that's probably all you need. That was one thing that I really liked, because, you know, that was one way they really made you able to incorporate dragons into many different levels of play.
Yeah. Well, moving on from our dragon talk here, we've got some more things to chit-chat about. One thing that I don't necessarily want to go through all of the different creatures that are in the book or out of the book and that kind of stuff, but one thing that I do want to mention is that gnomes are listed in the Monster Manual, which is significant because they're not listed in the Player's Handbook. It's been confirmed by now that gnomes will be a monster, but will not be a player race.
Right, and I think we covered that in our earlier episode.
Yeah, we talked a bit about that before. Yeah. And I even heard something, some stuff just today on another show, actually, talking about the Monsters and Worlds preview book that talks about how gnomes are connected to some of the evil races in the Feywild, which is a new plane that they're introducing where all the fairies and that kind of stuff are from.
Right.
And so they'll have a completely different role, which is going to, I imagine, change some people's campaign worlds.
Yeah, I guess we'll have to wait and see. It was interesting reading through this list of monsters that you had. I'm just looking at the notes that you provided me, just all these lists of, you know, what's in and what's out. It kind of reminded me of Survivor. It's like,
yeah,
all the monsters are on an island somewhere, and then every week, you know, they sort of vote on who gets kicked out.
Right. Well, and it's going to be a fairly exhaustive list. I'm impressed with the amount of content they're squeezing into it. They say there's going to be 288 pages with over 300 monsters.
Well, I guess that supports their assertion that the stat blocks are going to be reduced in complexity. Because if you're going to do that and have art and have flavor text, you better be concise in the stat department.
Yeah, because, I mean, when it's all said and done, you're looking at, you know, significantly more than a monster per page now.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a long list of things that we know are in and that we know are out at this point. We're not going to go through those here, but I'll just tell people now that if they want to check that kind of stuff out, I will provide that list on the forums. And so people can hop over there and see what's in and what's out and maybe make whatever their comments are about those things.
I'm just glad to get Yankee sticking around. I love that monster.
Well, and on that note, they talked about how even though there are some creatures being listed in the Monster Manual but not in the Player's Handbook, that the Monster Manual will provide additional rules on how to make certain monsters into PC races.
So kind of like what they did with Savage Species?
And I almost get the impression that it's even less detailed than that. There are some Monster Manuals now for 3rd Edition that at the end it'll say, you know, goblins as characters, and it'll give you this is what the stat adjustment would be, and these are the abilities, and just sort of leave it quick and dirty like that. I think it's going to be something more similar to that.
Let me ask on a personal note, is there a monster that you know is not being included that makes you sad?
Boy, I don't know.
I'm putting you on the spot here.
Yeah.
Let's keep it positive. What's a monster that's been confirmed that you're really glad to see is going to stay?
Well, I like that they've got a lot of the classics back. I mean, I look through the list of monsters that are in, and they seem like you know, they seem like the monsters that in my mind are D&D, you know? And so I like that they're bringing back a lot of the classic monsters, and they don't feel the need to completely eliminate a lot of the old baggage and create something new. Because there was always that fear that they're revamping so much stuff. Are they just going to wipe the slate clean and start over? But a lot of it looks like is that they're going to bring back a lot of those classic monsters that make D&D what it is.
So is there a monster or two that haven't been confirmed that you're anxiously awaiting to hear about?
Boy,
I'll start.
Go ahead.
I have a few. There's two that I'm really waiting on. One are the Slads. I really like the Slads.
Uh-huh.
I hope they stay. And the other one is, and I've never heard an authoritative weight on pronouncing this, but the Otyugh.
Uh-huh.
Otyugh.
Right.
I always liked that monster.
And see, I don't know that I've ever actually used that monster in a game. Maybe because I couldn't pronounce it.
I just remember in high school, I remember distinctly the entry in the original Monster Manual talking about how it lived on a diet of dung, offal, and carrion. I guess that really resonated with my 12-year-old self.
Sure. I guess if anything, I'm mostly just curious to see what's going to happen with dragons and with the outsiders. I've always been just a big fan of outsiders, demons and devils and angels and that kind of stuff. Even in mid and lower level campaigns, I've always sort of found a way to incorporate those when I felt like it was a good way to progress the storyline. So I'll be really curious to see how all that, you know, and those are some of the areas where we've gotten a lot of information. I'll just be sort of curious to see as we get more and more detailed information, how that looks.
Yeah, the outsiders are cool. I think that strikes a really visceral chord with most people, just having an encounter with something from a world that's not your own.
Right. Well, and it reflects a lot of personal philosophies and beliefs in the real world, you know, when you're talking about angels and devils and demons and that kind of thing.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, so we also have some information about how they're designing encounters. They're no longer assuming that there's one monster per encounter. Third edition, when they designed monsters, they sort of assumed that there would be one monster per encounter. That's why they created the CR. This is, you know, the challenge rating if you were fighting one of them.
Right.
They're now making it an assumption that there's the same number of monsters in every encounter that you have PCs. Which the idea behind it is to make it easier to scale your encounters. If you've got 5 PCs, have 5 monsters. If you've got 4 PCs, 4. If you've got 12 PCs, you have 12 monsters. And that way it's a little bit easier to sort of match up the difficulty of the encounter with the size of your party.
Yeah, I was surprised to read that because, I mean, that now you're going to have, you know, it essentially makes every monster a pack animal now.
Well, it does and it doesn't, because there's also been some mention of sort of a class of monster or different types of monsters that the assumption is that most monsters are that way, but then there's other monsters that are, you know, they're elite or they're whatever, and that means that they count for double, you know, so if you've got an elite monster, it counts as twice as many monsters. So if you got a party of 4, you only need 2 of those.
Well, they're just simplifying the enumeration then.
It sounds like it, yeah. Because, I mean, they actually made it fairly simple to do a lot of that kind of stuff in 3rd edition, but the math was a little bit more complex. I mean, it was 3rd edition was designed that it assumed that there were 4 members of your party. If you had more than that, then your party's appropriate encounter level went up by 1 point for every 2 party members that you added. And so the math is just a little more complex. Now it sounds like they're going to simplify a lot of that math and make it easier to figure out, okay, this is an appropriate fight, this is not an appropriate fight, and do things that way.
And I'm just surprised that they're taking so much of that responsibility on themselves. I mean, because they have no control over what size of party that people are going to play in.
Well, right, and I think that's some of the what they're doing to change things. You know, 3rd edition was built under the assumption that you had 4 players and a GM. Whereas 4th edition, they're trying to make it easier to say, well, you've got a GM, and however many players you have will make it easy for you to figure out what you need to fight.
Yep, good idea.
Yeah, I think that's a good move. Monsters are going to get roles, sort of like when we talked about classes. The roles are going to be different than the class roles. They're not going to be leader and tank, leader and manipulator and those kinds of things. But you're going to have different sort of roles for monsters, just to give a DM a hint as to how to play that monster. So you're going to have some monsters that it's going to say, this is the kind of monster that you want to be up front taking all the hits. Or this is the kind of monster you want to be behind all those other monsters, sort of shooting at them from a distance. Or this is the monster that stands back and is your support monster that's casting spells and you know, helping out their friends and allies, that kind of thing.
I think that's a really good idea. And I think that's going to really benefit new DMs, because I remember in my early days as a DM, it was hard enough just maintaining the map and keeping all the names of the NPCs and the details of the game straight. Having roles like that is probably going to help DMs to just use their monsters better and just remember what they're for. Because I can remember many times, not even all that long ago, where I'll throw a monster at the party and I'll completely forget that it had a certain ability.
Well, right, and one of the things it sounds like that they're doing is they're actually giving monsters fewer abilities to sort of eliminate that problem. They're going to have, there's not going to be the monster around anymore that can do 17 different things. It's going to have three things that it's good at, and you only need to focus on those three things and don't worry about all the other stuff, which I, on one hand, makes a lot of sense to me in terms of faster gameplay. On the other hand, I also sort of like the idea of a monster that's flexible. I like being able to use these three abilities in this situation. You know, maybe it's playing the role of your typical meat shield up in the front of combat. Or in a different situation, maybe that same monster is going to sit back and cast spells from a distance. I get the impression they're taking away some of that flexibility in order to fit them into these roles better. But I suppose if they just create more monsters or more creatures that fill in the roles better, then I guess it ends up working out the same either way.
Yeah, and I think you have to sort of take a step back and think about, what's the reason for creating 4th edition at all? And hopefully one of the things that we're trying to do is attract new players into the game. And 3rd edition, as it is, I think if you dropped somebody that was running role-playing games for the first time with 3rd edition, D&D, having never seen another game or system in their life, most of the people I think that played 3rd edition were people that had played for years and just were sort of moving along their journey as a gamer. But I mean, if the hobby is going to grow and thrive for years to come, they have to sort of make that entry-level game be something that a new player can wrap their head around. Because if you go back to the early days of, the basic D&D, that was, basic's not a put down, but it was an easy system to run.
Sure. And I think, it's a careful balance. And it's, of course, the crux of a lot of discussions and debates when it comes to 4th edition is how do you find the balance of bringing in new people and at the same time not alienating the base of customers that you've got. So it's something that they've got to sort of figure out, I guess. And I get the impression that what will happen is they'll make the core system as simple as possible, and then they can add the complexity in later for the people who want it.
Yep.
Now, there's two creatures specifically. I don't want to, again, we're not going to go through the list, but there's two creatures specifically that I do want to mention, because they're going, one of them is just sort of an interesting little aside that some people will be interested in, and the other one is we got some more information about how it's going to work, and it sounds like an interesting change for that monster. The first one I want to mention is the Shifter, which is it was actually a player race in Eberron, which is apparently going to be included in 4th edition as in the Monster Manual.
So is it a player race in 4th edition or just a monster?
It's, from what I know, it's not a player race yet.
Okay.
But it would be, it's one of those that'll probably make it as a player race eventually, but it will show up in the Monster Manual. And so they've got some unique Eberron sort of things that are being converted into the core system.
So for people like me that aren't too familiar with Eberron, give me the Shifter in 20 words or less.
The Shifter is a humanoid lycanthrope hybrid. And they get certain abilities based off of their lycanthrope side that allows them to sort of shift to their bestial side and gain certain advantages from that.
Oh, okay.
Sort of a half werewolf, so to speak. And then the other monster to look at is the zombies, which they say is going to look a lot more like movie zombies than what we're used to.
I think that's smart because that's a really popular genre right now. So that's another thing that would probably, if they played up zombies, you know, maybe created some zombie-specific adventures or stuff like that. That could be something that hooks people. I think that's a good idea.
Well, and it makes a lot of sense, too, because if you think of zombies outside of the world of D&D, they're a common trope in the horror genre. But if you fight zombies in D&D, they don't really come off as something horrific. At least not in third edition, you know. Very seldom do I fight a zombie and think, oh my gosh, something horrible is going on here. It's just, oh, look, there's another, you know, sack of hit points to beat down. And so I like some of the changes that they're talking about here.
Yeah, and that's probably just a product of them just keeping the zombies the way they always were. I mean, as I remember zombies in the early days, you know, it was an animated corpse and nothing else. You know, that was before the whole, you know, like the Day of the Dead movies took off, and you know, people had all these, you know, I mean, you think of a zombie now, it's something that, you know, shambles around, says brains, you know, and bites you and you become a zombie. I mean, people have that idea of a zombie entrenched in their mind. So I think that's, you know, why not include it in the game?
Right. And I like the idea that they're putting critical hits back in. In third edition, critical hits wouldn't work on undead. But with 4th edition, they're saying that, at least in the case of zombies, critical hits work, which makes sense because, you know, in every movie with zombies in it, you're looking for that headshot because that's what really takes the zombie out. And so they're putting critical hits in to sort of represent that headshot, I think.
Yeah, and I think that's a good idea because, in speaking of critical hits and undead, I mean, to say that, because undead has come to be, undead has come to be such a broad, broad term. Like, there's so many different types of things that are undead and correctly categorized as undead. But to say that criticals categorically don't affect them is kind of hard because you've got, you know, it makes sense for, you know, an undead that's, you know, incorporeal. But, you know, like you just said, you know, for a zombie that's basically just an animated corpse, I mean, why wouldn't a critical hit affect it? So,
right.
Going back to, you know, adjusting those monster by monster is probably a wise idea.
Yeah. And then we've actually also got a rather lengthy bit of information here about the Pit Fiend, going back to our discussion of devils. They had actually, on the website at Wizards, they have posted pretty much the full stat block of Pit Fiends. And so I included that into our notes. There's a lot of little hints and clues in there as far as what's going on with the rules and some changes and that kind of stuff. But all in all, I guess I like what I see for the way they've designed the monster and the way they've designed the entry.
Yeah, I mean, but it's funny. I looked at that. Like, did that look like, because one of the things I'm hearing the designers say over and over again, like on the D&D podcast, is how stat blocks are shorter and simpler. I mean, but I look at the stat block and it definitely doesn't look short.
No, it doesn't.
So, I mean, it's all stuff that I'm familiar with. You know, there was nothing that jumped out at me that, you know, I didn't know what it meant. It just seems to me that it's not really as short as I was expecting it to be.
Right. But at the same time, I wonder if that doesn't make more sense for a Pit Fiend because it's so high level, you know, given that it's a 26th level creature, it would make sense that it has a lot of information going on. And that, you know, in third edition, at a 26th level creature probably would have had a longer entry.
That's a good point.
And
the acid test will probably be for the more rank and file monsters to see what their stat blocks look like.
Right. And there is some interesting information, I mean, some interesting sort of things to pull out of it. as you look at that stat block, they list, you know, Pit Fiend, level 26, elite, soldier, leader. So you've got all this information right in the first line. It's a Pit Fiend. It's level 26. It's an elite monster, which means it counts for double. And I'm guessing soldier and leader are its role.
Right.
And then it also lists XP. So they're doing away with the CR system, I guess, of deciding experience points. And they're going back to the static experience point system that they used back in second edition.
Yeah, I guess people just like that better.
Well, I think part of the idea was that it's simpler. It's just easier to figure out.
And less subjective.
Yeah. And then there's also some things that don't make a lot of sense to me yet. They've used the terms bloodied and that kind of stuff in previous discussions before, but they list his hit points as 350, bloodied at 175. What effect that exactly is going to have, I don't know.
I took that to mean that they're, you know, just when it gets to 175 hit points, there's a series of penalties that's defined as bloodied that you automatically start adding on, which makes sense, you know, because one of the knocks that D&D in general has had is that, you know, you don't really, unless you're being attacked by something that specifically attacks your ability scores, you know, you're as powerful as 100 at 100 hit points as you are at one.
Sure. Of course, it also adds more complexity to the fighting system again. So we seem to be going back and forth of let's make it simpler and faster, and then let's add some more complexity.
But it's in the case of this, you know, this bloodied condition, I think that's appropriate because it's something that you'll have all the time. Because, you know, it's almost a closed book. Like, you know, if you simplify one thing in a role playing game, you know, you're almost inevitably making something else more complex. I mean, an example that I think we talked about earlier is, you know, if you put search, spot, and listen all in one skill, even though that's, you know, that's decreasing the number of skills you list on a character sheet, but that would increase the number of modifiers that you have to consider because, you know, if you have a deaf character, then, you know, their modifier on the, let's call it a perception skill.
Sure.
You know, you'll have to break it out that way. So I guess adding a level of complexity for something like a bloodied condition, because that's something the way that D&D plays that you're going to encounter over and over again, while it's definitely making more complex, it'll be something that, you know, just by virtue of the fact that you're doing it all the time, that people will probably get their minds around pretty quickly, if it is what I'm thinking it's going to be.
Sure. Some other things that I like looking at the new stat block is that they, or at least the entry in general, they list tactics for you right there for the DMs. They can read a quick paragraph and say, okay, this is what I should be doing with this creature in a fight in order to make them effective, which is really useful for DMs that aren't necessarily the super tactician.
Right. And also, you know, for a new DM that, you know, just, you know, may not have the rules for flanking or for any kind of thing just foremost in their mind, just having that narrative thing saying, you know, just reading the Pit Fiend here, a Pit Fiend fights close to its enemies. So, you know, that's easy to understand and pick up on and, you know, keeps the monster in the spirit of it.
Right. And I also like the part that comes right at the end, right after that, where they list lore. And that's something they've started to do recently with the third edition monster entries, and where they put a little lore entry in there and say, this is the check that you need to make, and this is the DC, and if you make this DC, this is how much information you get. If you make this DC, it's that much information. I really like that they've been doing that, and I like that they're going to continue doing that. Although it does bring up an interesting bit of change there. If you look, it says that for information about Pit Fiends, you're making a religion check. Which means, first of all, it's no longer knowledge whatever, it's just a plain religion check. And then second of all, normally a Pit Fiend would have been a knowledge planes check. So they're also changing it to a more religious thing.
Yeah, and maybe that's just a result of, you know, feedback they've gotten, because the number of knowledge skills you can have is effectively infinite.
Sure. Sure. So, and it makes sense, I suppose, that since the planes are the location of the afterlife in the game, it would make sense that religion would sort of cover a lot of information about the planes.
Right. And this is one of these mechanics that players are really going to have to get their minds around. Because like we said earlier, I mean, everybody reads the Monster Manual books and everything like that. So players are going to have to remember to keep in character that, you know, if they don't make that DC 25 check to know that pit fiends are the nobles of the nine hells, they're going to have to play their character accordingly in order for this system to really be a benefit in the game.
Sure.
But that of course, goes far beyond D&D. You know,
well, and right, and you have that issue in third edition and second edition and first edition. I mean, you've always got that issue of people reading information and then...
You've got that issue in role-playing games.
Yeah, just being able to separate their metagame knowledge to what their character might know. Well, unless you have some more to talk about with monsters, I think that's where we'll stop that little chit-chat. Do you have anything else to add?
Wizards, keep slads.
Keep slads. Did they even make it into the original Monster Manual for 3rd edition?
No, I think they were in the Fiend Folio, if I'm not mistaken.
That might be. I know they were included eventually, but I don't think they were in the original Monster Manual.
Because they were in 1st edition AD&D, they were in the Fiend Folio. So I think they put them in the Fiend Folio in 3rd edition as well.
Okay. Because
they are a planar creature.
Right. Well, I'm sure they'll make it in eventually.
I sure hope so.
All right. So there's our chit-chat about 4th edition news for D&D Monsters. And thanks for joining us.
Well, that's 4th edition Monsters. Now a quick promo from a show that I think you might want to check out.
Good evening, Jeffrey. What glories are you perpetrating at your table lately?
Well, Judd, we are playing Burning Wheel at my table, and my players and I are having an absolutely wonderful time creating a game world together.
I'm so glad that Luke Crane's Burning Wheel is doing well for you.
And how are things at your table, Judd?
Jeffrey, I'm glad you asked. Because me and my innovative friends are playing Dungeons & Dragons. However...
Oh, quite interesting. Do tell.
Rather than roll a d20 when combat presents itself, we are resolving combat through interpretive dance.
My goodness, that's brilliant!
Yes. When I take out my black leotard, the orcs quiver in fear.
You should go onto RPG.net and post about this. People will flock to our podcast.
No doubt. They will flock to the Sons of Cryos.
As always, I urge and welcome listeners to help the show in any way you can. Send in your emails or audio comments to thetomeshow@gmail.com or let me know if you're interested in reporting for the show regularly. You can also dig the show at dig.com or leave an iTunes review. These things help the show get noticed, and I really appreciate that. Also, don't forget to consider checking out the Tome's Amazon store. The show gets a percentage of the proceeds, and that helps keep the show on the air. All this information, the forum, and more can be found on the website at www.thetomeshow.com. Also, don't forget to check out the Tome's partner podcast, Fistful of Comics and Games, at www.fistfulofcomics.com for all sorts of geeky goodness, and Gamers Haven at www.canadiancrusaders.com for some great GMly advice. This has been episode 48, 4th edition Monsters of
The Tome.